I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. How are you doing?
I am doing well. I'm certainly doing much better than Mark Zuckerberg. Here's the thing about Mark Zuckerberg. The news said that he lost $7.5 billion in wealth this week, but he still has $77 billion in wealth. When you have $77 billion in wealth, do you even notice $7.5 billion going away?
Yeah, $1 billion used to be a lot of money. It's your first billion that's important. I mean, everything after that, I mean, what are you going to do with it? I mean, I've seen people, I think it's Betsy DeVos in the United States, her,
Secretary of Education.
Secretary of Education, who, you know, pioneered homeschools and Christian learning and all the rest. She's the heir to one of the fortunes, like Woolworths or something like that. And apparently she's got like 13 yachts. It's like, okay.
How many can you be on at a time?
Well, yeah, one yacht's, you know, what do? You jump from one to the other? I mean, maybe have them in different places around the world. I mean, this is like a whole different breed of human that I have absolutely nothing in common with. So it's really hard for me to understand.
I'm not certain that they are human. I don't think that they have any, that they're not connected with any human experiences. You know, human experience is about struggle and achievement and setbacks and overcoming setbacks. And when you have 13 yachts, you don't have that. And it just goes to show you how much things have changed. Because back in the day, Elmer J. Fudd was a millionaire who had a mansion and a yacht. And that was considered to be wealthy. And now it's, you have 13 yachts. At a certain point in time, money just becomes immaterial. It means nothing to you. You can have anything that you want, including becoming a cabinet secretary. As Zuckerberg has lost money, I wonder whether the loss is enough to change his stoic attitude towards allowing hate speech on Facebook. Because the reason he lost that money is because major advertisers like Unilever and all these others, Coca-Cola, I believe, have pulled out of, out of Facebook. Many others have pulled out of all social media, pulling all their advertising. And it's the big, I mean, Joe's Bike Shop doesn't advertise on Facebook, really. The big money that keeps that company at its value are the big contracts, the big brand advertisers like your Coca-Colas, like your Unilevers. You know, companies like that are what keep the Facebooks and Twitters and so on of the world afloat. And if they're pulling their money out because of extremely lax enforcement or lack of enforcement of hate speech on their platforms, then I don't imagine that Mark Zuckerberg is going to feel the pinch, but the shareholders are going to feel the pinch. So do you think this is going to see a change in how the social media platforms approach hate speech?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, the Facebook thing, you know, was started by the Anti-Defamation League under a campaign called Stop Hate for Profit. And, you know, they basically say, you know, okay, businesses, and you know, this is the only way that you attract anyone's attention, especially in the United States, is, you know, you hit them in the money. You can't appeal to their better nature. You can't appeal to philosophy, to the public good, or any of that kind of stuff. You have to say, okay, look, we're going to hit you where the money is. And it's the only way that you get any kind of attention. So like you said, a bunch of companies were feeling it. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League has a lot of political capital these days with everything going on in the United States with Black Lives Matter and everything else going on, you know, sort of a new awakening to these sort of things. Like you said, Verizon, Unilever, Starbucks, Best Buy, Coca-Cola, North Face, in Canada, Lululemon, Mech, and I never pronounce this right, Arc'teryx.
I know what it is, but I don't know how to pronounce it either.
it's a clothing line, they're big ones. I mean, and they've basically said that we're going to pull all our advertising dollars from Facebook. Now, they said we're going to do it for a month. It may go longer than that. I mean, so is it symbolic? Because, you know, it's money for them too. Obviously, it's of value. And like you said, Facebook. Last year, I just had the number written down here somewhere. Here, in 2019, the revenue was 70.7 billion US. So, you know, about 100 billion Canadian. And apparently this is, you know, they say it costs them about $7 billion. Well, it's 10%. That's something. It's
well, that was his personal, that was his personal wealth.
That was his personal loss, yeah. because the stock prices has dropped. You know, but it hasn't dropped that much. I mean, I'm looking at the chart right now, and it's bouncing around about 225 US a share. But it, you know, it dipped below when you've got a lot of shares. I mean, a little change makes a big, big difference.
Yeah.
So it's you know, it's coming off of highs that were closer to 250, but you know, and it's been as low as 146. I don't want to turn this into sort of into a market minute here, but you know, it you know, market sentiment is, yeah, this could be a problem, whether it's going to be a long-term problem or not. So his personal worth has gone down because the stock has gone up and down, but stocks go up and down. And like you say, it's your first billion that's important. It's not your last, $50 billion. That makes a big difference.
You know, so, he's got several mansions. And when I read that, I thought, you know, it's they're just buildings, because you can really only have one, like one home and one cottage.
You can only sleep in one bed at a time.
But as far as making it feel like a home, because there's things in your home that are there that accumulate over time, certain, you know, utensils you get, certain books, certain items in the house that warm it up, that imprint your personality on it to make the place feel like a home. It, you know, not like something that looks like out of a catalog. And how many places can you do that in? How many places can really feel like home? And is he just so emotionally distant from everything that he doesn't care or doesn't feel any connection to anything, that one building's the same as the next? Because I know that when we moved out of our home that we'd lived in for 18 years, we moved up further north, it was an emotional thing. I mean, we were moving to a bigger place. You know, it certainly wasn't a downgrading of any kind, but I still, you know, that was my home, you know, and it took a while for this new place to be home. And how much time can you spend and that was because of the time spent here and, you know, slowly personalizing the place. How much time can you spend in, when you've got several mansions, how much time can you spend in any of them for them to feel like home? Why do you even bother having them? I mean, I understand, okay, if he wants to have like a little home, like a home here, there, home there, different coasts or something, but do you really need mansions? I understand they need a security perimeter around there, but you can have land without having mansions. It's just like you said, it's an entire lifestyle and headspace that most of us can't even begin to step into. And as much as, you know, having unlimited money would be a great thing, if it means being Mark Zuckerberg, who appears to be distanced and detached from everyday life, then I don't know how, you know, sometimes money is too expensive, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly things more important than money, but it's hard to convince someone who doesn't have any money about that. I mean,
you need a certain amount of money before you can say there's more important things than money.
Yeah. But what's your basic necessities look at? I mean, I'm looking at Mark Zuckerberg's, net worth, which, goes up and down with the stock price, is about $80 billion. So if he cashed out everything, and, you can never cash out everything, because as soon as Zuckerberg says he's going to sell all the stock goes down. So your net worth goes way, way down. But, in terms of, hard assets and stuff, no one's going to be having a garage sale for him. But the problem, we talked about being emotionally distant as well. I mean, he's got two children, he obviously has human connections. But the whole concept of, sometimes these internet millionaires, whether it's Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, who are, Zuckerberg is 36 years old. Bezos, I think, is a little bit older. I don't know offhand how old Elon Musk is. But people of a certain age who grew, they seem to have grown up, if you're really, really successful in the internet space, they don't ask whether we should do something. They just ask how we can do something. And Facebook is one of those sorts of things where the morality of it has it's not even in the back seat. I think it's bound and gagged, and it's in the trunk of the car.
Yeah, it's tied up in the trunk with cement around its feet.
Yeah, so it never really occurred. I mean, the selling of people's data and all the rest. I mean, they go like, well, here is a real business opportunity. You know, again, it's sort of like the old robber barons where you don't really care about the human thing. It's all about, you know, making a pile of money. And Zuckerberg's Facebook is sort of built on those models. Because it's just, and Twitter has been a little bit to that extent, more than a little bit sometimes because of the platforms that they've given certain groups and people. They're getting a little more serious about it now. But Facebook knows that this is where their money comes from. It comes from the angry, the ignorant, the prejudiced. You know, it's not just grandma's sharing cat pictures and all the rest. It's political groups. It's it's angry Reddit with pictures. And I was shocked to see that, you know, in a short period of time in the United States, there's a statistic that I was looking for, but it was something like 40% of Americans get their news from Facebook.
Well, actually,
Facebook, it was never supposed to be a news platform. I mean, it was closer to 50, I think.
It's not just in the United States, Stephen. In Canada, and these statistics were current as of a few months ago, the largest, the place that most Canadians get their news from is Facebook, more so than CBC, global television, CTV news, you know, any other place, newspapers, it's from Facebook. And which surprises me because I don't get any of my news from Facebook unless you consider what my friends are up to as news, which I don't think it qualifies as. It is a platform that is huge for the dissemination of information and not necessarily accurate information.
Yeah, and I use social media. I mean, I'm a social media guy, and I use it. I do use it for sourcing articles and things. I mean, a lot of it depends on who you follow as well. And, you know, I try not to be too much in my own sort of little small L liberal Toronto lefty bubble. Although we're all prisoners to our own experience, but you know, I use it and I say, oh, there's an interesting article in the National Post that someone's talking about. Here's something in the Guardian. Here's something in, the New York Times or, you know, little tiny news sources that you wouldn't have seen or, you know, news clips that are from other, you know, I'll watch German news clips sometimes to see what, Merkel is talking about. So it can be a great news aggregator. There's a great word. Aggregator. It is can be an aggregator too. It's a great news aggregator, but you have to filter and be really careful about what you're picking on. And, you know, I'm forever losing friends on Facebook going like, really, you're quoting me Breitbart, or really it's the rebel media, or it's, you know, some, you know, it's Stormfront. Sure. That's a great source of news. And you point out to people like these people are, you know, they're either flunkies of a really right-wing think tank. I think I just lost a friend the other day over that, pointing out that the article he was promoting came from this incredibly right-wing, deep south, dark money institute that backs a couple of news publications, saying, you know, these guys just lie. I mean, you know, I don't mind uncomfortable truths, but I don't want people lying to me. And a lot of people just sort of are these gourmands of news. They just consume everything without any kind of being able to differentiate between, you know, what's great and what's terrible. And, you know, sometimes you need to see what the other side is saying and what crazy people are saying, just so you're ready for it and can respond to it. But people who constantly are consuming a steady diet of junk news results in not just Trump, but just sort of the emboldening of the racists and the bigots and the transphobic and the, God, you know, the stuff going on about Antifa now. You know, there's stories about Antifa's coming to the little town, and there's a thing in the New York Times on the weekend about all these small towns. Rumor comes by that Antifa's coming to town, and so everyone goes out in the town square with their guns, ready for Antifa to take over their town. And it never happens because it was fake news to begin with. But they go like, "We showed them. We chased off Antifa." Like, yeah, probably the tigers and the cobras as well, because, you know, they were just as likely to be coming to your small town in the Midwest as Antifa was.
But, well, Antifa is a boogeyman. I mean, as I've said before, I don't consider Antifa to even be real, because when you have no leadership, you have no membership, you have no spokespeople, you don't really exist. You're not really an organization. You're a slogan more than anything else. And
it's like people who like Gilligan's Island is a movement. It's like, no, it isn't. I don't even know if they got a fan. They may be more of a movement than Antifa because they probably even have a fan club.
Well, I like Gilligan's Island. I'm not a big fan of Antifa. though I am, I mean, I support anti-fascism. I support anti-racism. It's one of those weird things, and it's probably another topic altogether. But the whole idea that if you support anti-fascism, then you're Antifa. No, it means you're an anti-fascist. It means you're, you know, pro-equality and anti-bigotry. But that doesn't automatically make you a member of Antifa. The same way that I support the concept behind Black Lives Matter. I believe Black Lives Matter, and Black people, especially in the United States, have been so disproportionately oppressed by systemic racism. I believe Black Lives Matter. I believe in the cause. Do I necessarily believe in the organization that calls itself Black Lives Matter? They have made some very troubling comments. Some of their leadership in different cities, even in Toronto, have made some very troubling comments, which themselves can very easily be seen as being racist. So do I support the organization? Not really. Do I support the cause? Yes. But it's, you know, it's like I did an interview with Tom Green, and there's a separate Tom Green who's the person from the persona, but they're both called Tom Green. So, you know, he can not like the fact that people don't take him seriously as a person, but he chose to go out as Tom Green, you know, on with his real name, doing the wacky stuff that he did. It was wacky. It was brilliant. But it's hard to you know, for some people to figure out which is one and which is the other. I support the concept of Black Lives Matter and what they stand for. I don't necessarily support the group, which a lot of them are very ardent Marxists. Have made statements that are bigoted against white people, you know, and that's I don't support that any more than I support comments that are bigoted towards any group. So it becomes a bit of a morass there. It's a bit of a quagmire.
The problem with Facebook has been that they've allowed this to continue. I mean, the quagmire part of it to continue, because it's, you know, Facebook is not necessarily a place for nuance and deep thought, even though you can go a lot longer than the character limit on Twitter. I mean, but, you know, they've taken things like, and they've been so slow to act, but they've also done positive, you know, taken, you know, positive, not in the sense of good, but in the sense of they've taken active steps. Like they named Breitbart News a trusted news source on Facebook, and they made the Daily Caller a fact checker on Facebook. And you know, both of these groups work with white nationalists. I mean, they're sort of the polite jacket and tie version of the Klan. And Facebook has just decided, well, there's a market for this. And there clearly is a market for this. And therefore, you know, we're just here to serve the market. And that goes back to the amorality of not whether we should do it, but, you know, whether we can do it. You know, they've decided they're making a ton of money on it. And that's why they won't, deplatform Trump and some of the other people, because people are consuming this stuff. Instead of saying, like, you know what, we shouldn't be feeding these terrible, not just the fact that they're, you know, there's a moral judgment involved in the debate of right and left, but it's like we just shouldn't be platforming people who lie and incite violence and incite racial hatred, and they won't draw that line. And so you know, Stop Hate for Profit, the Anti-Defamation League, has come up with this boycott to hit them where they live, because almost 100% of their profit comes from Facebook's profit comes from advertising. So if you starve the bear, you know, maybe you can tame it a little bit.
Well, and I mean, Zuckerberg wraps himself up in that very American, I let everybody speak, free speech is a right, blah, blah, we don't have the right to be to censor. And the truth is, absolutely they do. Because every website, every platform has a terms of service that you agree to, which basically allows the website owner and operator to decide what's allowed and what isn't allowed. And you don't have any recourse because you've agreed to the terms of service. The same way when you go into somebody's house, you have to behave a certain way. And if you don't, they have the right to tell you to leave or change your behavior. So they wrap themselves up in the flag when, in fact, as you said, they're doing it not because of any overriding belief in absolute freedom of speech, but because they know that that's where their bread is buttered. And also they know that it's going to cost them money to hire enough people to go through and handle all the complaints that come through, because you're going to get legitimate complaints and you're going to get illegitimate complaints. You're going to get complaints about people who just simply don't like someone else's opinion. It doesn't, that opinion they don't like doesn't necessarily have to be something that is that contravenes the community standards that are set up on Facebook or other platforms, but it just be something that somebody doesn't like. And we're in that mode of society now where you read somebody having an opinion different than yours and you consider that to be offensive, that somebody should A, have an opinion different than yours, and B, the opinion itself. It's not the same as yours, therefore it is offensive. So you're going to get a lot of people sending in complaints, which means that they're going to have to hire a lot more people, which means that their profitability will, you know, the profit margin will go down. But, you know, my wife Leanna has been saying for years, there's going to come a time when there's going to be laws passed that recognize that platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, and so on, are publishers. The same as a newspaper is a publisher. And they're going to have the same liability as other publishers. It needs to be a little looser, because obviously there's a greater sense of control as to what goes into a newspaper or into a book that gets published and so on. But there needs to be some sense of responsibility for the kind of content that appears on a platform. If content is flagged and you do nothing, then there should be some consequence to that, because you are publishing that. To say that you're just a platform, that's the same as Uber saying that they're just an app, that they're not a transportation company. It's sophistry, and it's going to, I think now may be the time when that starts to, the chickens come home to roost with social media, and that this free ride they've had for so long of taking in money and not being forced to do any policing of the kind of speech that goes on, it's coming to an end. Now, of course, the kind of speech that typically gets deplatformed or complained about is stuff that comes from the far right, stuff that is racist, that hate mongers against anybody who's different than them. And you're going to hear from those people, they're going to scream like a stuck pig when they discover that they don't have free rein to just spread poison everywhere. They're going to say it's thought police and it's all left-wing people trying to control the media. They never, of course, are honest enough to say, well, what we're putting out there is really offensive and it's intended to stir up hatred. They make it sound like what they're doing is somehow a valuable part of public discourse, as opposed to something that poisons and is toxic to public discourse.
Yeah. And, you know, and how many of these things have popped up? You know, the, you know, Snopes is there playing whack-a-mole with things that are out there and really popular memes. And you know, I was reading one about Biden the other day about inter-school busing back in the 70s, and, you know, how they torque these sorts of things and produce these really catchy but completely misleading memes about things. And, you know, the left isn't nearly as good at, I like to think the left has a little bit more self-control and go like, oh, we can't say that because that's just not true. That doesn't seem to be anything that anyone puts their hands up and says in any of the right-wing organizations. It's like, oh, we can't say that because it's not true. It's like, well, will it work? That's the question. And people like Facebook or organizations like Facebook are basically monetizing the worst aspects of the First Amendment, where most of us feel that there's a certain amount of responsibility that comes with free speech, you know, to be accurate, to be fair. I mean, it's like what you said about journalism. I mean, journalism has a code, and the code is, you know, is it accurate? Is it fair? Have we checked the sources? Are we confident that it's true? And, you know, is there, you know, corroboration with more than one person if we're breaking a story? Do we give people a fair opportunity to reply to these things? I mean, I say my family's been in the newspaper business for 100 years without a break, so, you know, I'm familiar with a lot of these rules. That's one of the reasons that Rebel Media says we're not journalists, because they don't do any of that stuff. You know, and they say, well, we're just entertainment, masquerading as news, because they don't follow a code of conduct. They're not accountable to a standards council that is, you know, usually self-regulating. But yeah, all of these internet businesses, whether it is Facebook, Amazon, Uber, Airbnb, I mean, they celebrate them as disruptive, and basically Americans celebrate them because they've made a ton of money, and anything that makes a ton of money is worthy of celebration in the United States, no matter how you've made it. Mm-hmm. But all of these things, like Uber and Airbnb, these disruptive internet businesses have all made money by breaking the rules. I don't mean breaking the rules in the sense of, oh, these guys are pioneers. You know, Airbnb and Uber broke all the rules about taxi cabs. Uber, they don't want unions. They don't want trained people. They don't want people, they've skirted all the insurance rules for the longest time. So, if you got into an accident, it was basically the driver, because you're just a contractor. We don't have any responsibility for the delivery of the services. We're just a portal, like you said before, so for people to connect with each other. Same with Airbnb. I mean, terrible things have happened at Airbnb rentals. I mean, houses have been trashed and people have been shot and house parties and all the rest of the stuff. Airbnb goes like, no, we just put people together. And so they've made their money breaking all the rules about that regulate hotels and taxis and online businesses and taxation, sales tax and all kinds of things, through the shipping, not to mention all the labor laws that they're always breaking when it comes to part-time work and all the rest. So they've made all this money by not following any of the rules that we set up for all these established businesses that we set up for good reasons, to protect the consumer, to protect the workers. And Facebook is just another one of these things that just says, "Nah, we're not going to follow any of these rules about content or about checking. We're just a place where everyone can throw any idea up there. And First Amendment, it's not up to us to decide what's hate speech and what isn't."
Well, the thing is, it is a very difficult thing to determine what is hate speech and what isn't. But it's much more difficult for the government to pass laws. I mean, we found even here in Canada that it's very difficult for them to pass laws against hate speech because, who decides what is hate speech? Now, it's fair to say, well, the government decides, but people have a problem with that. However, when you own your own platform, you can decide what is and isn't hate speech. It's not something that really can be challenged in court, because when you sign the terms of service, that is a contract between you and the platform, which supersedes anything else. So, you're not signing it under duress. So there's no way you can claim that it's not you didn't make a valid choice when, allowing that platform to decide for themselves what is and isn't acceptable in, intercourse it's a bad word to use, interaction on their site. So it's really just corporate cowardice and fear for the bottom line. And these platforms don't seem to have any conscience whatsoever about what kind of toxicity they're allowing into public discourse. They don't seem to care about the oversized effect that this amount of back and forth, this amount of toxicity is causing in society. They're basically playing a fiddle for money while everything else burns. And I know that it was probably a lyre and not a fiddle that Nero used, but nonetheless, the metaphor remains the same. And we'll have to see because if you say you're going to have a boycott for a month, well, companies are like, well, just batten down the hatches for a month. You really need to have a boycott that doesn't say it's only going to last a month, because a month, a company can weather a bad month. And there's no really real need for them to make any serious changes if they know that in 30 days things will go back to the way they were. You got to have a boycott that stays completely open-ended, and is that ending the boycott is hinging on the companies taking serious steps, not little shadow fence in the dark against this, but actually taking steps to curb the outbreak of hate speech and disinformation on their sites. So, we'll see.
It is a two-way street. Obviously, these big time advertisers are getting something out of it. They don't spend their advertising money for no results. It's clearly a value to them. But so after a month, you know, they may be feeling the pinch as well, saying, okay, well, we made a stand. It's kind of blown over now. Facebook has, you know, made a couple of statements about how they're going to clean up their act, whether they do it or actually or not. So, you know, we can go back to advertising there, because advertising through Facebook is a very valuable market for us to spend our advertising dollars on. So, you know, it hurts both of them, this boycott. And the question is, you know, at the end of the day, is it going to stick? Because it's a valuable service with all of its flaws. You know, I think of something like any of the food delivery services, you know, Foodora or Uber Eats or all the rest. A lot of restaurants absolutely hate them. And initially, there was a lot of pushback from food establishments saying, we're not going to participate in this because, you know, the food shows up cold. There's always, you know, a couple of French fries missing because, you know, the drivers aren't paid enough. The fees involved in participating in Uber Eats or Foodora or Skip the Dishes or whatever else means that the profit margins for restaurants that are already pretty slim get even slimmer because of the fees that they charge for it. But everyone starts asking, you know, can I order it through Uber Eats? And eventually, even though you don't like it and it costs you money or it's not costing you enough money, it's a problem not participating in it. And they may find that with Facebook as well, that you're seeding the field to other. So if Coca-Cola, this is just an example, so I don't want to get, mm-hmm. you know, hate mail from the mm-hmm. lawyers for Coke or Pepsi. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if Coca-Cola says we're boycotting Facebook, Pepsi goes, hey, there's a real opportunity. We can dominate that market share for the next month because Coca-Cola is nowhere to be seen, and we can actually produce, you know, a ton of clever ads and own that space. So when they come back a month from now, we've got a real advantage over them. And that's, you know, that's capitalism red in tooth and claw. It is it's the way it works. So it's really hard to get a lot of people on board about this because there's always someone who doesn't have as big a commitment to the moral stance that a lot of these companies are taking when it comes to Facebook advertising.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see what happens, because this is we're still, even though we're you know 15, 20 years deep into social media, the prominence has been increasing, you know, like the crest of a wave, and its impact has been increasing, and it's still in some ways the undiscovered country. We're not quite sure yet how this is all going to shake out. And we'll see if this recent fleeing of advertisers from social media platforms does produce anything substantial or anything long lasting. But as far as long lasting relationships, we should maybe switch over to talk about the relationships between Canada and the US and Canada and China, as this whole controversy continues to swirl about the Huawei executive who's being held here in Canada. On the request of the United States.
Yeah, you know, Meng Wanzhou, I mean, it came up last week because the families of one of the Michaels hired a lawyer and a Supreme Court justice to draft an opinion about whether or not the Attorney General of Canada, who is ultimately responsible for extraditions, has the authority to step in an extradition hearing and withdraw his or her support from it and basically make the extradition go away as a way of, you know, I don't think there's anybody who doesn't understand you know, what the problem was. You know, Meng Wanzhou, she was detained in December of 2018 in Canada. I think she was passing through Canada, and she is a very, very senior executive for Huawei, and she is, you know, she's considered Chinese royalty. Basically, that's the best way to describe it. She is an incredibly important person in China, and when she was passing through Vancouver Airport, her flight on Cathay Pacific, she was met by border service agents, and then arrested by the RCMP. Couple hours later, because the United States was seeking her an extradition on fraud charges related to supposed violations of sanctions against Iran, that they were falsifying documents so they could get around the American embargo on Iranian sanctions. So, you know, they were trying to clear transactions with, they were lying to banks is the allegation, in order to, so they could clear transactions with Iran through the United States. So the Americans have said, we want to talk to her. Canada, if she comes in your sights, grab her for us. And Canada did, because, you know, we have an extradition treaty with the United States and all the rest. The other week, just to finish off the story, a couple of within a week or two of it, two Canadians who are generally referred to as the two Michaels were grabbed by the Chinese. They were grabbed on espionage, which in China is you know, as big as the government wants to make it. I mean,
there's a history of communist countries, authoritarian countries, grabbing people on charges of espionage, these very vague charges of espionage. And like you said, the definition of espionage is, it can change day to day depending on what the government wants it to be.
Yeah, they say, so they grabbed, you know, actually a former Canadian diplomat, Michael Kovrig, and Michael Spavor, they were grabbed in the same month, in December of 2018, and were held on suspicion of it. And, you know, in China, you can be held on suspicion without actually being formally charged, and they have recently been formally charged with spying, but there's no details about it. I worked in China for about 12 years. I wasn't in China. I was working in Canada, but I probably went to China 24 times, and I was working with members of state-owned enterprises, and met with government leaders and Communist Party officials and all the rest. And you know, China is certainly a big black box. I got a little bit of a sense of China and the way they look at things. And the whole idea, of course, is that these two Canadians were grabbed on trumped-up charges as leverage for us to release Huawei executive Ming Wenzhou, which is, again, is a real authoritarian, where you don't have the rule of law. Everything is basically an extension of the government. So, you know, the Justice Department is an extension of the government, and foreign affairs and the corporations, and Huawei is sort of considered an extension of the government as well. And so it is pretty clear to, I think, pretty much everyone that Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor were both grabbed in retaliation and as a bargaining chip to release Meng. But the Chinese don't understand that, you know, we don't have that same government relationship that they do, which is the government waves a wand and says, okay, you know, Justice Department, just let her go. It's too much trouble. Canadians are like, no, we got a process. And while it is technically true that the Attorney General can withdraw their support for an extradition hearing under the legislation, it's built into the law, because extradition always does have an element of international relations and diplomacy in it, because, you know, there will be some people, it's just like, you know, we're not going to honor this extradition because it's to a country, it's to a country we don't really like, or it's too hot to handle. So the minister can say, no, we're not going to do that. But they're after SNC-Lavalin, the government's really gun shy about getting involved in a process that's ongoing before the courts. And, they're not prepared to do that, even though legally, and this is what came out last week, legally, they can do it.
Well, yes, they can do it, but should they do it becomes the question, because it is rational to believe, first of all, I think the Chinese do know that we can't just wave a magic wand. They don't care. They, as far as they're concerned, they don't care what our internal politics are. They just know the result that they want, and they're going to push and pressure until they get that. And while it's true that the Attorney General can withdraw the extradition request, the the long and short of it is that anytime we do anything that the Chinese don't like, they can grab a Canadian in China and use them as a hostage. If we allow this to work, if we allow this tactic to work, they'll do that. Now, the flip side of that is they'll do it anyway. Anytime, you know, whether this extradition goes through and Meng is sent to the United States or not, even if we let Meng go and go back to China, the next time we do something China doesn't like, they'll still grab Canadians and use them as pawns. So either way, it's not going to deter China from using this. If it doesn't work this time, they'll try it again next time. And so, but we do have treaties, and you know, we're governed by laws and treaties, and we're not the United States, which just says we're going to abrogate this treaty because we feel like it. You know, the U.S. under Trump has very much been, yeah, we don't like it. So, and why don't we like it? Well, because a previous government brought it in and it wasn't ours. And so we're going to abrogate the treaty. And everyone rightfully criticizes them for that because it makes them an unreliable ally.
Well, just last week, Trump was, you know, NAFTA 2 is barely, the Inca is barely dry, and he's saying, I'm going to put a 10% tariff on Canadian aluminum again. It's like, wait, so we just went through this. We have a treaty. And, you know, the Americans are like, nah, doesn't suit me today.
Yeah, I mean, especially under Trump. I mean, how many years has that international dispute resolution panel between Canada and the U.S. as set up under the original free trade agreement ruled that softwood lumber, the U.S. Has been illegally acting on softwood lumber yep. imports, and that the panel directed the U.S. to stop it, and the U.S. said, nah, we don't care. A panel yep. that was set up by them bilaterally with Canada, they yep. just decided, yeah, that's what you said, but we don't really care. We're still going to yep. do what we want. And who can really push them to do otherwise? They rely on us for a lot of resources and a lot of business. That's true. But we rely on them for the same amount, you know, as customers in the same, yeah. the same amount. So we don't have the leverage to make the U.S. Come to heel and obey their contractual obligations. But
we don't have the leverage with China either. I mean, like you said,
we don't have the leverage with anybody, quite frankly.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of imports, you know, as a market, we're kind of small. As exports, you know, in the United States, it's important, but, you know, we could certainly, you know, get tougher on Chinese investments in the oil patch or in telecommunications or in a couple of other things. But, you know, that's small potatoes to China. I mean, they've got much bigger markets than little old Canada. And, you know, Canada's stuck between these two bullies. And, you know, my position was, you know, that we probably shouldn't have grabbed Meng in the first place. We should have done an oops and just said, oh, wow, sorry, U.S. She got by us and avoided all of this stuff because, you know, sanctions are kind of, they look kind of political to begin with. And, you know, it's a real hot potato. And the Americans were basically making us do their dirty work for them. And, you know, they haven't. You know, there's not a lot of gratitude coming from south of the border for Canada over any of this. It's, you know, we're really between a rock and a hard place here. And there was just a poll, the Angus Reid Institute just did one and said that about half of Canadians says we shouldn't have arrested Meng in the first place. But the majority of them say that that we should now let the courts run their course. And only, I think they said only about 28% say they would rather the government negotiate away, do a prisoner exchange, Meng for Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor.
Well, we don't want to be seen as an unreliable ally because while, yes, Trump has not been a good ally to Canada throughout his term, it's very, very likely that he won't be the president in several months from now. And we don't want our friends on the other side of the border to see us as an unreliable ally. We want to be seen as a stalwart ally, even though the U.S., when they choose to, they, you know, they, instead of kicking the dog, they kick Canada. But I don't suspect that the next president, who I think will be Joe Biden, will continue with the anti-Canada and basically anti-Western ally policies of the present administration. And we want to be seen in a good light, that we stuck by our treaty obligations, even though it cost us, you know, even though there were international costs to us diplomatically and to a couple of our citizens, we said, hey, we have an agreement and we're not fair weather friends. We don't just bail out of an agreement because it becomes inconvenient for us. So I understand the emotions behind the families wanting these two men back. I would like come back. Yeah. But unfortunately, international policy, international politics is bigger than any two individuals. And that's real politics. Like, that's just the way that it is. And, it, you know, if we take these, if we drop, let Meng go and we bring these two guys back to Canada, the next time the Chinese will be encouraged next time to do, we do something they don't like, to just grab a couple more of our citizens. Like I said, they probably would do it anyways, even if it doesn't go their way this time. But there's no point encouraging them to do that, because we don't know. Maybe if they realize it didn't work this time, then maybe next time they'll be a little slower to take that. Maybe they'll find another tack they can take. But who's to say? And again, this is also an unfolding situation.
Yeah, and you know, my little bit of experience with China, you know, if I wanted to make a bold prediction about what's going to happen to the two Michaels, is, you know, traditionally what the Chinese will do is they will put them on trial. You know, they will, you know, they'll try to get a confession out of them one way or another, you know, to say that they were spying for somebody. And, you know, spying could be anything from taking a picture of a military installation that, you know, is in the middle of downtown Beijing that everyone knows is there and gets your picture taken in front of, but, you know, they're going to make an example out of you for doing it. Or to, you know, some kind of corporate stuff where, you know, you met with somebody and were exchanging information of a non-political, non-governmental nature, but, you know, China decides that it is actually a state secret or something. But for whatever reason, they will have a trial in probably about a year. They will convict both of them. They will sentence both of them to 10 years, which is the traditional Chinese sentence for this sort of thing. And after a year and a half, they will release them just to come back to Canada. They'll just say, you know, your sentence is up, and without fanfare, put you on a plane and they'll be back in Canada. And that's what Beijing does to people like this. And that's what is likely to happen, because, you know, if they can't get their way with Meng, then they will just keep going. And like you said, there's no guarantee that if we did like you can be sure that there's been negotiations of some sort or other going on, you know, not with Meng being released, but, you know, Meng is living in her mansion. She's not sitting in a jail cell. She's not as uncomfortable as the two Michaels are being made by the Chinese. You know, if she was a little less comfortable, maybe the Chinese would be a little more,
motivated,
let's say. But, you know, it is going to cool. You know, I've done business in China on a couple of different deals. I'm not sure I'd go back there at this point, not that I'm important or anything else, but it's just sort of the capriciousness, the arbitrariness of the system, mm-hmm. and the lack of recourse. And Canadians, you know, like you said, Trudeau's in a tough spot, because on one side, people are saying, you got to do everything you can to get them out of there. It's got to be, you know, that this is terrible. Trudeau's not acting, and, you know, he's not protecting Canadians. And you know that the diplomatic, wires have been just burning over this thing, trying to get something. And the Chinese are just not interested. So, and like I said before, there's no leverage at all that we can bring to bear on the Chinese. So on the one side, people are saying, do everything you can to bring them home. And on the other side, they're saying, well, don't give in to blackmail, though, because that just emboldens the Chinese. It's like, it's the only lever we've got. And, you know, and Trudeau has said, no, I'm not pulling that lever. I think much to his credit. But like you said, the downside of it is the two Michaels will languish in jail and probably be convicted and probably serve a tiny bit of their sentence before they ever see Canada again. And it's sad. It's terrible.
Well, of course. And that goes without saying. But often individuals, the fate of individuals pales when compared to, you know, interactions between state entities. But we'll see. We'll see. On both the topics we talked about today, we'll see. This is still an unfolding story. But hopefully people who are listening, who were confused about what was going on in these stories, got a grounding and some basic information and opinions from us. And they can take that and pursue that further if they're interested. If not, well, they consider themselves a little bit better informed than they were when they began. And that's it for our show this week, Stephen. And I want to encourage people to please keep us going, support us by becoming a patron, becoming a supporter of this program and the kind of programming and information we bring to you. Go to, if you want to be a monthly subscriber, which we greatly appreciate, you can go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/FUNetworkTV. Or if you want to give a one-time boost, that's also greatly appreciated. You can do that on PayPal through our email address, FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Thank you, Stephen.
Hey, thank you. Always great to chat.
And by the way, happy 30th anniversary.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yes, my wife has been putting up with me for 30 years now, which is pretty hard to believe. Anyone could put up with me. And, you know, it's kind of the triumph of, for those of you looking for a triumph of the human spirit story, I started off as a divorce lawyer. So, you know, if we can make that work, then anyone can.
Well, congratulations to Rhea as well.
Well, thank you very much.
And you go out, have a good time tonight. Have a great anniversary dinner. And to all of you who've been listening, I hope you have a good evening, good afternoon, good morning, whenever you're listening to this. And please, if you enjoyed the show, let other people know that you enjoy the show. Pass it on. Word of mouth is great. Our programs get upwards of about 60,000 listens a month now, which nobody's more happy or surprised than we are. I shouldn't say surprised. They are good shows, but it's hard to find good shows amidst all of the other chaff that's out there. So thank you for continuing to listen, and please let other people know that you enjoy these programs. And for Stephen Lawtens, who is on Twitter at Stephen Lawtens, Stephen with a P-H, L-A-U-T-E-N-S, and I'm Stephen Kersner on Twitter at Stephen with a V, J. Kersner. I want to thank you for listening, and you've been listening to Stephen and Stephen on FUN, the FU Network.
This is FUN, the FU Network.